So I'll just give a short introduction and show some comparison cases for relativistic collision shocks. And I'm trying to make a case to make a classical Santa Barbara comparison in this field, similar to the ones that have been made in several other fields. And it's a discussion session, so feel free to interrupt at any time. So what do we want to learn from peak simulation in this context? Well, I think three things. We want to understand the physical mechanisms that are responsible for the shock transition. Which mechanisms are there and how do they interact? And what's the resulting average shock structure? And one detail there is that we can't do this for, or we don't want to do that for realistic mass ratios. So we want to understand how things scale with mass ratio when we do simulations at more affordable ones. The second thing we want to understand is, of course, the topic of this workshop, namely particle acceleration. What are the mechanisms of injection and main acceleration? And the third thing is important. How can we actually compare our predictions with observations? And to do that, we need to compute synthetic spectra from the simulation so we can have anything to compare with. We can't just compare between ourselves. That's rather meaningless. So there are a number of problems and also just tuning choices when running peak simulations. I mentioned grid heating already in the discussions, and there is another thing, which is numerical Cherenkov radiation, where particles travel faster than the grid speed, the grid field speed. But then there are a number of tuning parameters, the mass ratio, the number of particles per cell you choose to use, and the number of cells per Eskin depth, per Debye length, and also less obvious ones like the spatial order, temporal order of the operators that are part of the setup that can actually affect things like the Cherenkov artificial radiation very much. Something else that also affects the constant in front of numerical noise is how you scatter and gather, how you take information from the particles and give it to the fields, and how you take information from the fields and give it back to the particles. Previous comparisons have turned out to be extremely useful. There have been comparisons in cosmology, in turbulence simulations, in radio transfer methods for reionization of the universe, for how to diagnose the structure of molecular clouds, for example. And they've all turned out to be very useful. They've been performed through the last 10 years or so, typically. And the need for similar comparisons in our case is even larger because there are a larger number of issues and they're more subtle and more hard to pinpoint. For example, in the case of MHP codes, there's relatively few and easy things to focus upon. They can be handled very differently with different methods. But typically what you find there is ripple if you under-resolve things and not so impressive power spectra if you over-resolve things. So relatively straightforward to look at the results. There's, for example, one coming out from a workshop that was here 2 years ago, pretty soon this year. Right. We're also further from reality. We can almost never simulate a particle case directly. There are maybe exceptions for lab cases on a very small scale. But most of the time, we have to rescale our things to attack astrophysical problems. I come back to that in the very end with a suggestion to you. So here's a list of the previous comparisons, or some of them. The very first one, most famous one, was put on the archive on 1999. I don't remember when the program was, but probably a couple of years before, because this involved a number of groups, a large number of groups solving the same problems. And the one I just mentioned about MHT turbulence was from a workshop 2 years ago, and it's being handled by Alexei Kritsuk at San Diego. I also mentioned in the discussion session the Wengen comparison that ultimately led to Volker Springer's development of the AREPO code. There have been some in the protoplanetary disk dynamics case, and a very important series of comparisons have been done by Ilyev concerning cosmological reionization. All right, so let's take a look at what we can show you, what we can illustrate the issues with. And this is stuff done by my associates at the Niels Bohr Institute, Jakob Krier-Fredriksen and Rufus Hagböller are postdocs, Klaus Galsgaard is my colleague, and Gisela Baumann is a PhD student. So we're actually looking at particle acceleration in the context of solar flares as well. And we've done work on GRB shocks since several years. So there are essentially two different complementary setups for studying collisionless shocks. You can use a reflecting wall, or you can use a steady state setup where you choose to be in the frame of reference of the shock. Of course, you're studying exactly the same phenomenon, so it's just a technicality. But it's an important technicality, because in the case of the reflecting wall, you have for quite a while in the beginning artificially reflected particles. Everything is reflected, so you have a bunch of fast-moving particles moving to the left. And only after a certain amount of time are they diluted and no longer of importance. But there is a shock, there is a front traveling out to the left if we have this orientation that essentially never goes away. In the case of a steady state setup, the main difficulty is constructing the exit boundary conditions such that you have a constant outflow. And I don't want to go into details, but we've used an idea by Michael Hesse, and that works very well, actually.
But you have to know what the velocity of the outflow will be to begin with, right?
So in the reflecting wall setup, you have this accumulating dense part which is traveling to the left with approximately half the speed of light. And that's the setup that Anatoly has championed and used very successfully. I think in most cases you actually have a growing box that gets larger and larger. We've tried a technique where we peel off the right-hand side and we add neutral layers on the left-hand side, and that way we can follow the shock. And that works, makes it possible to go on essentially forever, depending on computing time.
One difficulty with that is, if you're talking about non-magnetized shocks, there's usually particle precursors, which moves basically the speed of light.
Yeah.
So you have to have some sort of boundary condition on the left to carefully remove those particles.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, you have exiting boundary conditions for the fast part of the...
Right.
That's rather trivial, actually.
Then you have reflections of waves.
We have damping of waves at the exit boundary. So there are advantages and disadvantages of these setups, and I don't want to spend too much time on that. So let's just go on to the actual demos here. I don't want to take up too much of the whole time either. So in the case of a paraplasma, we can illustrate some of the difficulties with a standard setup, gamma equals 3 shock, that we resolve to different extents. It turns out that if you under-resolve in various ways, for example, too few particles per cell or too few cells per skin depth, you get characteristic phenomena. For example, with too few particles per cell, you tend to get this, maybe hard to see here, but perpendicular structures in the filaments, and the filaments become too wide. The crisscross pattern that unfortunately is rather invisible in the screen here. With this particular color scale, one picks up weak patterns at the bottom of the interval. So it's designed particularly to make things that are not really that important but still visible. But unfortunately, it doesn't come out on the overhead here. But there is a crisscross pattern that is the Cherenkov, numerical Cherenkov radiation. And that happens if you have too few cells per skin depth, particularly that drives the Cherenkov instability. So it turns out that in order to have a very nice and smooth setup that resolves the fine structure and the filaments very well, you need to have something like 16 particles per species in the upstream region, and then of course about three times that in the shock region. And unexpected large number of grid cells per e-skin depth. And I think there's a point to be made here. Some people argue that you only need to resolve the skin depth, and then everything that happens below that is sort of uninteresting. That's not true. I mean, the skin depth determines how close these things are. But once they form, they tend to become very sharp. And their width, their size, is essentially determined by the debye length. So as you go by to towards the shock, more and more of the kinetic energy is dissipated into temperature. And therefore, the electron temperature and the proton temperature increases, and the width of these filaments increases until they merge into a mumble jumble of turbulence on the right-hand side. So to get that process right, we actually have to resolve sub-skin depth. And it's easy to just make experiments and test what happens if you don't. So here the numerical Cherenkov is more obvious even on the in the screen here. Let me show you the same thing in a different context or with a different technique. These are one-on-one comparisons where I'm blinking different cases. The first one is 2D versus 3D. 2D is, of course, much cheaper. But we know fundamentally that it's different, at least in the jump conditions. I'll show you that it also makes quite a difference in the structures of things if you go to 3D from 2D. And the second part is, again, addressing the resolution thing. And the final one is about grid aspect ratio. So if you have, for example, a gamma 10 or gamma 15 or a gamma 100 upstream, is it absolutely obvious that you should have an aspect ratio of 1 on the left-hand side? Well, you can just take it as an empirical question and check. What happens if I take the same cost of my numerical experiment and I make the cells a bit flatter or a bit longer? Which case is the better one?
Before you go on, the 2D versus 3D, what about the question of ignorable spatial coordinates?
Yeah, I haven't thought about that.
But it's pretty basic. I mean, it can be proven that...
Yeah, but I mean, reality doesn't have any ignorable coordinates, so it's just a question of, in one case you have a 2D truly ignorable coordinates, or in another case you have something called maybe 2.5D, where you have something in that direction too. But both of them, whatever you do in 2D is different than 3D. So here is a particular case. Same particles per cell, same cells per skin depth, 2D, 3D, 2D. So what happens in 3D is that the filaments become much longer, much more correlated, but the shock location is essentially the same. So if you're only asking for the shock structure and the shock location, 2D is fine. If you want to worry about particle acceleration, diagnostics, synchrotron radiation, jitter radiation, it really makes a big difference to go to 3D.
On Marxism.
So let's take the next one-on-one comparison. Here is a standard case where we have a number of particles per cell and a number of cells per skin depth that many people would say is sufficient. So this is 2D and 8 particles per cell, 10 cells per skin depth. And if we go to 60 particles per cell instead, so we change the number of particles only, the shock actually moves. So the shock speed was not correct with too small number of particles per cell. If we compare 60 particles per cell and changing then, I'm sorry, that is not the right comparison I wanted to make. Because it's I've changed two things at once here. That wasn't really the intention. So the real comparison is this one: 8 particles per cell, 8 particles per cell, 27 cells per skin depth. And there you see that you actually retain the right shock position.
Do you have particles streaming to the left in this steady case?
There is some shrank of structure here. I mean, this is the upstream coming in, and that's affected a bit by the microshrank.
That's all I'm asking.
Okay.
Particles that we can't see, are there any that are leaving the left end of that box?
Oh, this is the case where you peel off the exiting part. So we are in the lab frame. We sit in the same frame as the reflecting wall, but we left.
This is a reflecting wall.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. This is done with the reflecting wall, but we're peeling off the right-hand side. So we're letting particles exit that way to keep the box the same size.
The shock is still moving on the grid, right?
Sorry?
The shock is still moving on the grid in this case or not?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. But the downstream plasma is stationary on the grid.
So finally, let's look at what happens if you change the aspect ratio. This is gamma 15 case with an ion electron plasma with mass ratio of 16. And the main argument here is, of course, that if you look at the plasma oscillations in the frame moving with the incoming stream, it's Lorentz contracted. So if you think about the skin depth in that frame as isotropic, when you go to this frame, it's very much compressed. And indeed, if you, I haven't included that case, but if you try going to a longer cell in the streaming direction, which could be argued for because these structures are actually elongated. So you might say, okay, let's waste fewer cells in the elongated direction. That doesn't work at all. It becomes much worse. And in fact, it becomes better if you do the opposite. If you go to a flat aspect ratio, you actually tend to resolve the structures better at the same computational cost. This is always a question of compromise, of first deciding what is the computational cost, and then choosing the number of particles per cell, the number of cells per skin depth, and so on. Typically, the cost per particle is the dominant one, which leads to somewhat of a paradox. You can choose a certain number of particles, and then you might say, well, I might as well pay 10% extra for a large number of cells. But the consequence is that you have very few particles per cell. You resolve, for example, the skin depth very well, but you have very few particles, and that leads to numerical heating. So there's a sweet spot somewhere in between where you utilize the computational resources best.
In this case, your time step has to be smaller, right?
Yeah. Yes, yes. So it's absolutely non-trivial to make these compromises. That's another reason to have an open discussion between groups and document that. Let me just finalize with something slightly different and perhaps provocative. So the solar corona is potentially a very interesting laboratory because it's accessible, it's observable. And some of the approximations inherent in MHD are clearly valid in the corona. the bi-length are a few millimeters, and the sizes are hundreds of thousands of kilometers. The motions are mostly slow enough to be sub-relativistic. But the one thing that's not true is that you don't have many collisions. The mean free path in a corona loop is typically comparable to the loop size. So it's neither small nor large. And that's an interesting boundary region where you can easily have runaway behavior, the fastest particle form a runaway population. And it's a really excellent study. But this is the main problem. You have a Debye length that's terribly small in a problem that's rather large. So that in principle makes it inaccessible in exactly the same way that VSA is inaccessible to big simulations. So in the solar case, we address that by simply rescaling. We rescale the fundamental parameters so that the Debye length becomes resolvable. And with the current numeric capacity, we can now actually attack that problem with PIC codes with basically the same resolution that people used in MHD codes 2 or 3 years ago.
Excuse me, what would be the Dreiser field in this runaway problem?
Sorry?
What would be the Dreiser field for this runaway?
What would be the...
I mean the thermal velocity compared to the velocity where the runaway takes place, where collisions start to be too confined particles. You mentioned runaway, so the electron runaway in electric field.
Oh yeah, I mean, typically energies that are measured is GeV. Yeah? So you accelerate ions and electrons to the GeV and you observe white light flares in the strongest cases. Huh? So there is a, in what's well, called solar flares, most of the energy are actually dumped into accelerated particles, more than local dissipation.
When you told that you rescale the problem, you increase in the bilanes, it means that you consider plasma is much higher temperature?
It means that we mess with the fundamental constants. We reduce the charge. We reduce the fundamental charge.
Okay.
So the phenomenon that has been observed and which is working as a test case here is something called coronal jets, which are observed near the poles of the sun, observed with the Enoda satellite. And that's been studied by Fernando Moreno and Certis and others a couple of years ago. So they can model that with MHD pretty nicely, and the acceleration of particles is due to reconnection in a structure that's well understood. And I don't want to go into details here, I only explain that with the PIC code that we have, which is very similar to what others have, we can scale to thousands of cores, and we can attack that problem with a resolution of about 300 to 400 cubed. The time it takes if you want to have a round number for PIC codes is around 2 microseconds per particle update. And then you can just figure out how long time it takes to update a snapshot with about 1 billion particles. And here's an example where we actually see a power law developing as a function of time. This is from this is a number of snapshots over a time period of only a few solar seconds. Yeah. And my suggestion, here is an earlier visualization by a master student. This is a test particle visualization of particle motion in the same case. It's not a self-consistent one, but it just shows where the acceleration would take place. And my suggestion here would now be the following. So we made it accessible in the solar case. Can one do the same with diffuse shock acceleration? Invent the problem where the fundamental constants are just chosen so that the problem is resolvable. If there is a theory for particle acceleration, it should be applicable, even if one has messed with the fundamental constants. And that would then be a test case that would be accessible to simulations, and it would be for the first time possible to compare.
Do you have any suggestions? I've never thought of this before. It never occurred to me. So, but just changing the charge.
You have to play with them all. You have to play with all, and they only come in certain combinations. There are papers written about what you can and cannot do with with the rescaling. But it's a well understood topic. So this is my summary, and I don't want to repeat it. I'll just pass my stick on to Anatoly and Ken. I don't know who's...
You showed that the fine structure do depend on resolution, functionality, and everything else. What about integrated quantities? Have you seen particle acceleration?
Of course, integrated quantities are much less sensitive. That's what I already said before, that if we're only interested in shock propagation and shock structure and integrated quantities,
Particle acceleration, and that's a very clear thing to check.
Yes.
Looking after small-scale structures is in my opinion.
Yes. But the point I wanted to make is that acceleration probably has a lot to do with the small-scale structure. That's where you create the strongest electric fields.
I actually haven't seen that, because I compare acceleration that I see in 3D and 2D, and they're basically the same.
Then you're welcome to come with a comparison suggestion that shows that. And we can all confirm your result.
Well, so the simulation that you just showed in 3D, do you see particle acceleration?
We haven't looked at it.
Why?
We've just done it. We've been running on Pleiades with an average of 8,000 cores for 2 weeks now, to make all these comparisons. Because in order for comparison to be meaningful, you have to change one thing at a time. And I gave you a list of the first 8 or 10 factors you can change. So we've carefully chosen a compromise where the price for a run is a few days of computing at 1,000 cores or something, not too much, not too small. And that's what we've been doing recently. And you're welcome to come talk to us about the details. We can even get the data and look at whatever you want to look at.
So the thing that I've been doing is Louis Silva's group and I, they took my parameters, they run their code, they got the same spectrum.
Yeah.
I took Krishna's parameters, I run my code and got his results. So that's the way we've been doing comparison. But we can all work on the same problem. It's just harder to, there's inertia in making everybody doing something at the same time. So.
Well, the lessons that were learned from the previous comparisons were of several different types. And they included also ideas that were present in one context, were applied in another context, and it was very fruitful. I don't think it's a fruitful approach to say, well, it's all the same, and there's no point in doing a comparison. So,
can you comment your simulation on collisionless reconnection in 2D and 3D?
Yes.
Do you have some convergence toward the view of Drake of collisionless reconnection with Whistler, Range?
Yes, that's indeed one of the things we're very interested in. And very briefly in MHT, there is a very fundamental difference between reconnection in 3D and 2D. So in 2D you have to have some boundary condition that drives things into an X point. But in 3D you have the twist and the pressure from the third direction doing that for you. And it creates a hierarchy of structures spontaneously. So if you have something which is just not trivial, the structure will make sure that you dissipate what you need to dissipate, and it's sort of auto-generated. So it's certainly extremely interesting to look at turbulent situations in 3D and the particle acceleration aspect. It's just becoming accessible.
It's micro turbulence, not MHD turbulence.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So who's next? Yes.
So, is there a pointer of some sort?
Stick over there.
Stick. Okay, stick is good. Good. So I wanted to talk about what I did this summer.
No laser pointer?
So this summer I've been trying to go into the non-relativistic shock regime, and it's been a challenge. And so there's you can talk about work in progress. This is really just unfinished work. So I'm going to show you where I am right now with non-relativistic shocks, and good thing it's on the record. Okay, so I tend to show this diagram a lot. Basically, the open questions that we want to understand, both for relativistic and non-relativistic shocks, are essentially the same. So it's including shock structure and injection or actual acceleration, and this effect of electron-ion energy transfer, which is only accessible to particle and cell simulations. And it seems to be quite important, both for shock structure and acceleration, and also this question about B-field generation. So in terms of collisionless shocks, it's important to remember that there are all sorts of collisionless shocks existing, both spanning the velocity and the magnetization range, and all of these beautiful objects are shown here in the relativistic and non-relativistic realm. And it's important to think of all of these parameters at the same time, and when you try to do that, your mind wanders off in different directions. So what you want to do is do something systematic about exploring this parameter space. So since I'm at Princeton, we like surveys. So I made this, and it's not what you think it is. So what I've been doing is systematically trying to explore different regimes of shocks, basically varying two important parameters, the magnetization and the speed of the flow, so going from relativistic to non-relativistic regime and changing the magnetic field, both strength and orientation. So the PIC methods don't need to be described here anymore. The code that we have is this descendant of Tristan code, which we call Tristan MP. So it's essentially run-of-the-mill code with a lot of optimizations for massively parallel problems. There are some special sauce things we put in, such as filtering of currents. So when we quote the number of particles we use, it's not the ultimate number. So there is also, if you include the filtering of currents, that can actually reduce noise for the same number of particles. So comparing just the number of particles between codes is not the only metric to do. Okay, and the good thing, as far as I'm concerned, is that some of the results are being confirmed by independent codes and different groups. So some of the things are consistent with what other people are finding. Okay, so in the relativistic regime, we found that shock physics changes with magnetization. So basically, independently of where you are on the gamma factor range, the shock physics is dictated by filamentation at low velocities or magnetic reflection. Filamentation at low magnetic fields or magnetic reflection at high magnetic field. And that what's low and high is basically somewhere around 10 to the minus 3 in terms of the ratio of magnetic energy to the kinetic energy. In terms of so the physics that separates the two regimes is when particles gyrating in the magnetic field line can undergo streaming instabilities when this beam is interacting with this beam. So if the Larmor radius is very large or magnetic field is very low, this interaction can give you filamentation, and it's shown here. If this Larmor radius is not long enough, it doesn't take a long time to go back, then you're seeing this kind of sharp transition, sharp gyration. Okay, and in terms of acceleration, we see what I think is Fermi acceleration only in the in the case of the unmagnetized shocks. So we see particles going back and forth and accelerating into Weibull turbulence, and we also see acceleration in subluminal relativistic shocks. So when the magnetic field is almost parallel to the direction of motion, we see very good acceleration. We don't see acceleration in the superluminal shocks so far, another important effect is that we see efficient energy transfer between ions and electrons in this case. So you've all seen this spectrum that we find in pair simulations. So we have a thermal peak and a tail. Just to show you a trajectory of how one particle gets accelerated. This is a relativistic case, Weibull turbulence in the background, and you're seeing this particle going into the upstream, then being advected into the downstream, and it wanders back and forth. At the same time, its gamma factor is increasing, so when it's in the downstream, nothing happens to its gamma factor. We're in the downstream frame. Then when it crosses, boom, there is a jump in the gamma factor as it was scattered by the incoming flow, and it's going to cross again. And so forth. So if you have, and the size of the particle is a gamma factor, so it's getting fatter and fatter as it goes around. So there are many examples like this, and so I claim this is diffusion and shock acceleration in the classic sense. The reason it works here is because the magnetic field is out of plane. In the two-dimensional simulations, basically reversing magnetic field. So there are zeros of magnetic field, the particle can find its way around zeros of magnetic field and get upstream. If we stick it to the magnetic field, and we've done some magnetized simulations as well, then if the particle is stuck and the flow is superluminal, it cannot get very far upstream, nothing happens. If it's subluminal, it can do exactly the same thing. And also, in addition, you have some shock drift acceleration. Okay, so this was also, the spectrum was also confirmed by Louis Silver's group. All right, so let's go into the non-relativistic regime. So here you have, in addition to just these two parameters, you can have many more parameters like temperature upstream, the turbulence level, and so forth. So let's just stick with the cold upstream and mean field only cases. So essentially, what we have is this setup when we, again, scatter against the wall, and the upstream is carrying the magnetic field, and we can vary the angle of inclination of this magnetic field, we can vary the velocity of the shock, and we can vary the magnetic field strength. So far, the parameters I've tried vary in mass ratios between 25 and 1,000. So if you're really desperate, you can do 1,000 for relatively short simulations. But mainly I've done 25 to 100 as most of my simulations. The typical velocities I've tried go from 3,000 to 30,000 kilometers per second. So it's in the right ballpark. The Delphinic Mach numbers we've tried from 3 to about 200, actually, not 100. Just the typical parameters, if it's 1,000 kilometer per second shock, 25 microgauss, you get Delphinic Mach number of 18. If it's 3,000, Delphinic Mach number is 54. So this is just the typical numbers to keep in mind. Okay, so let's look at some simulations. So what I'm showing here in all of these panels is different quantities. So here, this is the density average through the box. This is a two-dimensional simulation. So this is the density. This is the momentum space of the ions. So negative means that the ions are going left, and then they're scattering, and you see ions coming back and forming this reflected ion population, which forms the shock foot, which is this enhancement in density over here. Your eye will see little striations in color. This is not real. This is just an optical illusion. This is the momentum space of electrons. I didn't say that this is a quasi-perpendicular shock. It's about 75 degrees inclination of magnetic field in the upstream, and the field is in plane in this situation. So this is the density as it looks like in the two-dimensional plane. This is the magnetic energy. And this is the out-of-plane component of the magnetic field. And so what you see here is that, so the shock obviously forms. It's a magnetized shock. You can see clearly gyration of the ions here. Where the ions are coming back, you form various waves that propagate in the upstream. So there are these oblique waves that appear in the shock foot. Their action is not entirely clear to me, but they do exist. And now what's shown here is the average kinetic energy of each species. So this is the ions. Initially, all the energy is in the ions. So, and then this yellow is electrons. So initially, almost no energy is in electrons. But by, when they go through the shock, they gain about 20% of the ion energy. So if you ask what is the temperature ratio, you get 20% in the downstream. So this very efficient heating happens a lot in these simulations. And as far as I can tell, it's not sensitive to almost anything. So I've tried resolution, mass ratio, speed. We always get some appreciable heating in the downstream.
You know the mechanism for the heating?
It's related to the interaction in the shock foot. So just a note, I mean, this is a survey, but this is fairly wide and shallow survey. Okay, so I've tried things, but I haven't dug very deeply because most of them didn't look interesting enough to dig in. The reason this didn't look very interesting is because it didn't have much acceleration. So if we look at this in the frame of the shock, this shows the spectrum 50 skin depths behind the shock, and this shows the spectrum 50 skin depths in front of the shock. So in front of the shock, the red is the ions. So you see the incoming flow, reflected flow. These are electrons. Electrons will show various interesting things in front of the shock. But in the downstream, they're mainly thermal. There is maybe a tiny bit of acceleration, but it's not very robust. Okay, this is what quasi-perpendicular shock Mach number 5, Alphanic Mach number 5. So now let's go to 15. You're starting to see that there was instantaneous, it looked like a viable shock. There were some filaments, and then they turned around and formed what looks like now a magnetized shock. So you can see again the reflected ions coming back here. So if you don't run your simulation long enough, it will look like you have a viable shock. If you run it longer, these filaments turn around and make magnetized shock. Again, temperature is about 10-20% in electrons. This is the temperature ratio. Again, there are some waves in the upstream, and they're correlated with this reflected ion component. As far as acceleration is concerned, not much is happening in electrons. The ions are not completely isotropic yet by the time you get through this configuration. One interesting thing is that the magnetic field is corrugated along the shock. So we start with essentially a uniform field, but when it goes through the shock, you get these very strong rippling along the shock front. You would think this would be important for particle acceleration. It doesn't seem to do anything.
Can you understand injected ions or not?
Hold on. I wouldn't put that in the first slide, would I? Okay, so again, this is the same thing. Mach number 15. Okay, this is 45. So it takes longer for the shock to form. It looks very weibullish in the beginning, but then eventually it turns around. You get a very strong overshoot. Very strong corrugation along the shock front. Again, temperature equilibration is becoming more and more, so as you get higher and higher Mach numbers, you get more and more energy put into electrons. And finally, we go to 140, and this is basically a viable shock. So you see filaments, and Tsunihiko Kato here did a lot of work on these non-relativistic Weibull shocks. They do manage to form. This alligator finally closes its jaw, and you actually form a shock if you run it for a very long time. You get about 50% of energy going into electrons. Very good equilibration. I don't think it's numerical. I've tried a lot of things, but anything's possible. So, okay, so this was quasi-perp shocks. So now let's look at quasi-parallel shocks. In this case, this is purely parallel shock. So this is velocity 30,000 kilometers per second, Mach number 5. So it's fairly strong magnetic field and 0 degree inclination of the field to the shock. So the mass ratio is 30. So what you're seeing here is the density. So there is upstream, the downstream, and then there is this transition region, which seems to develop and become wider over time. This is the momentum space of the protons. So they come in, they get reflected. You can see some protons are coming back towards the upstream along the upstream magnetic field. So there is a streaming of particles. You also see some, you're starting to see some acceleration of protons. And so this parallel shocks are the only places where I see good proton injection. Now, what's interesting about the shock structure is that, so this is the density profile, this is the magnetic energy profile, and what you find is that by jump conditions, the magnetic energy shouldn't be changing through this shock, right? It's a parallel shock, the magnetic field shouldn't have done anything, except it does. So the very far upstream and very far downstream, the magnetic energy is basically the same. But in the transition, you have very strong generation of transverse magnetic fields. So what happened here is that initially magnetic field was like this, but at the shock it starts to wind up a wave, a circularly polarized alphane, I would say, wave, driven resonantly by the incoming flow. So what you see here are the waves that starts to appear at the shock transition. And with time, this region of the wave field seems to be increasing.
You said that they are driven by incoming.
I think that they're driven by the incoming, yes.
But what carries this wave? I think incoming flow is what is carrying this wave upstream.
There is no, so okay, you can see that there is a wave that starts to appear in the upstream. So the downstream wave appears very fast. Now you can see that there, in front of it, you can also see some wave that starts to be generated. Okay, and this one I think is driven by the particles coming back.
Oh yeah.
Okay, the temperature equilibration is 100%.
Natalie, how many dimensions here?
This is 2, but the particles are moving in 3D. So 2 spatial. The field was initially in plane. Okay. So
it's always right-hand polarized wave.
Well, it's whatever is needed to be resonant with the particles moving in that direction. So, if you look at the spectra, this is jumping around a little bit. So the ions actually start to get a tail. If you look at the downstream spectra of the ions, you see a tail in the ions, but nothing in electrons. Electrons are very nicely Maxwellian. So what's going on here? What's accelerating these protons? So we looked at the particle orbits. Now, you can see here that in the shock frame, it looks like this wave is just being wound up continuously as the shock is sitting there. This is non-MHD, right? The MHD predicts no magnetic field in that direction. Okay. All right. So this shows the trajectory of an ion that's been accelerated at the shock. So what you're finding is that, so this is the gamma factor of the ion as a function of time, and you can see its orbit as it goes around the shock. So what you see here is it's kind of doing the shock drift acceleration, but I put quotes on the shock drift because it's a shock drift in the reversing field. So the field is doing this. The transverse field is doing this, and the particle manages to be resonant at the right time to come back upstream and get accelerated. So if there was a mean, so the shock drift typically talks about the mean field. So if there was a net transverse mean field, you wouldn't have as many cycles. The fact that you can actually rotate the field like this helps the particle to go back and forth and be resonant with this transition region. So that's the best case so far I've seen at the injection of ions. Now, what happens later is that these ions start to propagate upstream. And if I run this simulation very long time, I find that in the upstream, these waves start to be generated. I think these are resonant waves. These are not Bell waves. So I see in the upstream, you start to wind up this circularly polarized field. Okay.
Does not compare this with all hybrid simulations like Quest and long is the same waves, the same amplitude more or less?
I haven't compared carefully. It looks on the surface similar, but I need to do a careful comparison. What makes the transition between these magnetized and Weibull shocks? So the transition matters. What matters is the effective transverse magnetization. So how much transverse magnetic field you have. So this transition from magnetized to unmagnetized, you have a field basically at 90 degrees to the flow, would happen at a much lower magnetization than it would happen for almost parallel field. So what matters is basically the transverse component of the field. So for 0 degrees and Mach number 45, you have essentially Weibull filaments. If you took the same Mach number but 90 degrees, you would get a very nice magnetized shock. So what about acceleration? This is where it gets kind of depressing. As far as proton acceleration is concerned, the best case I've seen is the parallel shock. So this is this parallel shock where you have this slow ramp up to the downstream compression, and this is the energy of the ions. You can see there are a lot of energetic ions sitting on the shock, and that was because they're just kind of going around here and gaining energy. And some of them get transmitted into the downstream. So if you look at the downstream spectrum, you get a nice tail in addition to the Maxwellian. The electrons are pretty much dead in this case, unfortunately. So what about electron acceleration? The best case I've seen so far is actually for perpendicular shocks. So if you have about 70, you have, even it works even for 90 degrees. So if you have a 90 degree inclined shock, you get these tails, which are very similar to what was found by Amana and Hashina. So they will talk about, Hashina will talk about this next week at the conference. And effectively what happens there is particles are accelerated at the foot of the shock. This is a shock surfing type of mechanism. Okay, so this is my result for the spectrum, and this is the simulations from Hoshino. The upstream in their case is over here. This is the downstream, and the claim is what's driving this acceleration are electrostatic waves that are created at the foot of the shock, so where the ions are turning around and coming back. And these electrostatic waves is what seems to be confining a particle electron as it gets accelerated. So it's an injection mechanism. It's not the ultimate answer. So it's not going to drive you to extremely large energies. You're obviously going to be limited by the size of this precursor. But so far, this is the only thing I've seen that seems to work. This question about 2D versus 3D. So I've done a lot of simulations in 2D, and I convinced myself that in 2D, so you can have two configurations. In 2D, you can either put the field in plane, or you can put the field out of plane. So I convinced myself that in 2D, actually, what's important for the shock structure is actually the field in plane. If you actually do a three-dimensional simulation, this corrugation of the field along its direction is most important. So if you do it in 3D, this is basically a 3D snapshot, and the corrugation still happens in three dimensions. However, what's important for electron acceleration is actually the field that sticks out out like this. So what you need to get the electron acceleration is you have to resolve the ion orbit, the plane of the ion orbit. So in the case, so if in my 2D simulations like this, the ions were, plane of ion orbit was transfers to the screen. Okay, so I wasn't resolving the ion plane. And I wasn't getting the electrostatic waves that were driven by the ions when they turn around like this. If you do it in 2D with a magnetic field like that, you get electron acceleration. So if you do it in 3D, you get the best of both worlds. You get this corrugation to give you the shock, and you get electron acceleration in 3D. So
are they accelerated predominantly along the field?
No, I don't think so. I have to check, but I don't think so. There is no electric field out of the board, so...
But it shouldn't be. It could be stochastic acceleration. Waves can propagate.
No. If you actually do a simulation with magnetic field exactly out of the plane, it's going to stay two-dimensional. They're not going to get any velocity.
Yeah.
Okay, so let me wrap up about the heating. So this is the... this is the two kind of extreme cases of heating that I have.
Yeah. What you were just talking about was quasi-perpendicular.
Yes.
You talked about the electrons. What about the ion acceleration in 3D?
One second. Yes. Yes, Lorenzo. No, tell me. I'm on this slide. Yes.
No, he's missing. No, is it real time? It's not real time.
Yes. Yes. Okay. Excellent. Thank you. I'll get back to it. Thanks a lot. Okay. So this is what I call real-time research. He was checking. Lorenzo was checking the normalization on the spectrum. So he says it's 1% of acceleration of electrons and 3% acceleration of the ions in terms of the numbers of the. Of particles. So, so ions were quasi-parallel, and electrons were quasi-perpendicular. The problem is that I don't get electron and proton acceleration in the same shock. You can choose your poison. We only have protons or electrons.
For protons in the parallel case, you've got about 1% of the protons.
Yes, 3% by number and the same about by energy. Okay.
That's very high, actually.
Yeah.
But this is not the final. This is the injection, right?
Right.
Okay. I'm glad this worked out because we were pushing it to the last moment. Okay. So the temperature equilibration. This is the case of the parallel shock, where I get the most temperature equilibration. So basically, the ratio of temperature is 1 downstream. For quasi-perpendicular shock, I get about from 10 to 40%, basically. So it varies a little bit with various parameters. It depends on speed, magnetization, but I never saw 1%. So I wish there was an easy way to explain this empirical relationship between T over TI and the shock velocity in the remnants, but so far it doesn't look like I can do it. Okay, so just to conclude, so we see non-relativistic shocks do form in the PIC simulation, similar to the relativistic case. They're actually a bit harder to work with because the run times are actually longer than the relativistic shocks. We see significant amount of heating. It seems like the perpendicular shocks show less heating than parallel shocks. So if supernova remnants don't show a lot of hot electrons, maybe you have to go to perpendicular shocks, but then that would kill.
That would be reasonably consistent with the 1006 observations, I think, of the alpha.
So I don't know, for what it's worth. At the moment, there is no smoking gun here, but these are the inferences that I'm getting. All right, one thing about this acceleration in the Weibull fields, and this was kind of interesting. So if I take a relativistic simulation where I have Weibull alternating magnetic fields, and I get this nice acceleration in the relativistic case, and I just take the same simulation, keep it pairs, and lower the velocity. As you go to non-relativistic regime, this acceleration tail becomes weaker and weaker and weaker, and at some point I cannot distinguish it from the Maxwellian. So that could be numerical. Or it could be the fact that at lower velocities you just need to wait very long. And if you wait very long and you have some numerical noise, the tail may never arise. So that regime we need to carefully investigate. So as you go to lower and lower velocities, the electron acceleration may require much higher number of particles per cell. So far, again, this was just a survey. I was just doing the least I could, the least possible computational effort I could afford, just to explore the different regimes. But it seems like at low velocities, you really need to crank up the resolution to get some acceleration. Okay. All right, and finally, I think for the parallel shocks, if these ions are indeed doing what I think they're doing, we really should switch to hybrid simulations because there is no point in running it with PIC. Electrons don't seem to be doing a lot in that case. Okay, and I'm obviously open to comparison of codes, and it's an excellent idea. We should definitely come up with problems. I would advocate actually comparing shocks than comparing instabilities, because this is a problem which with very clear initial conditions. You know how to start it, and it doesn't matter how you start it as long as you get a shock, and then we can compare everything about it and see if we've converged. Okay, so I'll stop here.
It's harder to keep it in the system. You have to have a bigger system.
Okay, so today I'd like to talk two things, which one is not talked by anyone. One is already two nice talks. So just only difference and some other things. Oops.
Turn on mirroring.
This one? I need to work the last time. Oh, okay. Thank you. Okay, so this work done by many collaborators, and three of them is attended this workshop. And then today I'm going to talk about one different shock structure, which I'm doing a little different way. And one is recently we started for the spectrum. So that hopefully we can compare with observation. So today I'm going to talk about very briefly, especially main difference from other simulations. And then this is already done just briefly how to calculate radiation from using a two particle. And this is a recent one. And also during this workshop, I started two different ways, and also fine-tuning the getting a spectrum. So this is a different simulation way. So we put ambient magnetic field and the ambient plasma. Then we inject on one side. Then we can see what's happening. So we can see foreshock in this way. And also we can see the trailing shock, which I'm going to talk about in more details. And this is a comparing other simulation, but a small, but at least for electron positron case, we can show at least some shock structure. So this is maybe easiest way to what's happening when you inject the electrons, I mean a jet. So obviously this is a direction of the jet, and you inject jet, and this is ambient. Then you can see jet is accelerated, and because some of them is decelerated, and then background is entrained with jet, and then you can see this particle can be Fermi acceleration, but we haven't checked the trajectory, so we don't know. But at least we can see some higher energy coming up shock front.
Sorry, I'm not entirely clear what you. Can you go back and show the previous slide?
Okay. So we put ambient magnetic field all over uniformly.
Okay, so you put ambient field and magnetic field.
In this case, no magnetic field.
Okay, just.
Yes, sorry. I started for the simulation, but this case is no magnetic field. Then injected uniformly, like a piston.
Okay, so you basically shine.
Yes.
Particle beam.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
Your jet is in fact a particle beam.
That's right.
Part of the piston.
So not piston, but literally injecting a particle.
Neutral.
You're creating two stable stability.
Yes, that's also, yes.
That
involves
in something.
Then this is a kind of result. So I think this movie shows how this is a condition. Of course, I just plotted just only portion, so that's a pretty big number. This is, of course, cold ambient. And this is a jet injected. Because gamma is 15. Then you accelerate, and then you can see these are kind of entrained. And this, of course, creating a shock. And the previous my shock simulation is up to here, so we started a little something, but no shock. But it's long enough to show the shock.
So the origin of those clearly accelerated particles.
Yes, here. Yeah. So
where's the shock? The shock is back.
Okay, that I'm going to talk a little more detail because we need to compare with other simulations. So obviously this is a foreshock. As far as I know, if you reject, you cannot see this part. So you kind of, this part is corresponding shock, not a simulation, so which I'm going to explain.
The electron phase.
Yes, electron. So this is electron positron. So positron is almost same. So I did, but obviously no reason to, yes.
And the beam, the jet is warmer though.
Yes, you get warmer.
No, we're getting
yes, a little bit. Yes, a little warmer because that's right. This is from the beginning. This is pretty cold, and also some included for from the how do you say? You're right. It's a little warmer. And also included gamma, that reason a little bit open up. Then this is a structure which I'm going to go a little detail. So this is a jet is injected. The jet is of course not much different. Of course, foreshock a little bit slanted. then ambient is kind of moved away with jet. So you can see the so this is a we call washout or leading shock. And we call this one maybe trailing or reverse shock. Then obviously we have contact discontinuity, but of course moving and not really clear. But we calculate it using a 1D hydro. Then we can get like this area, like a 0.76 or something, which I'm going to. And then obviously this one could be a Fermi acceleration, but we never really followed, so we don't know what's going on. And then when you hit this area, this is only parallel, not gamma, so slow down, obviously. Then of course this is the energy, energy or force to pull the back ambient. So this is the same thing, and we calculate epsilon B and epsilon E, and also obviously in this area, so-called downstream, and this upstream. Downstream is EV is much smaller than upstream. And then this is a jet is of course moving, which I'm going to show moving. So this is a jet and moving. No, because the very front is almost same as the initial velocity. But obviously, this is continuous discontinuity, which calculated from the simulation. Then sort of this area fit. And then this is a shock for the trailing shock. Then up to here. So this is a this like a half of that speed.
What is the density ratio?
Density rate is, I think, 0.7 of the background. Jet is 0.76. I can't remember the exact number, but it is smaller than the, This is a jet. This is, I think, 12 and 8, they're roughly, of course, particle in the cell. So 0.67, I can't remember the exact. And also, if you like to know the detail, we have a paper out. So, and then this is a movie, so we can show what's happening. So this is density, and then this is a background. Is a background electron is moving away, and also multi-fields are getting stronger, but this area is and interesting, this area is some sort of electric field and multi-field. This could be this electric field may help for the so-called surfing acceleration. But we haven't checked it yet. And this is a sort of what I have been kind of wondering on also how we compare with it. So this is of course Anatoly's simulation why it's flipped over to compare. So the jet is coming this way and then deflected. So in other words, this is a zero is a fixed contact discontinuity. Then there's a density or jump. This is that we calculated, so 3.21, and the beta C, mean for the shock velocity is 0.47, and this gamma. In our case is, of course, the contact discontinuity is moving, so we in the frame of the contact discontinuity thing, we can calculate the same way, then 3.36, and the artillery like a 3 something, so fundamentally very similar result.
Sorry.
Yes.
Two digits precision. I don't see a flat portion of that.
Pardon?
I don't see anything flat.
Yes, you're right. So this is only roughly somewhere here. Yeah, and also this is a short enough. So not like your simulation very nicely flat yet. And then also, the reason this is okay is, as I showed the movie, not really going up and down, sort of, at least for this simulation. So roughly this area. Of course, hopefully, if we do long enough, this is smooth out a little bit. And now at least this flat area going to be a little bit longer. But
I'm surprised that your reverse shock is as strong as the forward shock.
You mean this is supposed to be weaker than this? And so that's another reason we didn't call any back shock.
It should look like this.
So this is a...
So the forward, this is the reverse.
Oh, I see. So what kind of content of is this?
You hold that up.
So what kind of situation this is?
It's the same as you.
Okay, so.
Оценка Теслон from hydrodynamic simulation. Yeah, what picture?
So this is a peak simulation.
No, I'm asking. I think from hydrodynamic simulations, it is known.
We do MHD simulation. Different, very different. Yes, I know that. We have a paper for that also.
I just need to wait another factor of 10 in time.
Yeah, I think we don't know yet. So at least for this part, and then at least for comparing the same continuous discontinuity, the similar. So what I want to say is at least some sort of quasi shock or something creating. That's only I say. I don't want to say this is it. And obviously we need to do a much longer simulation. So at least number sort of things that, and also, of course, this is not very steady. Of course, the simulation showed up and down a little bit, but at least some sort of bulk shock structures are coming up. So, and also, obviously, here we had jet is hitting the very strong thing happening, the same as other. I mean, in this case, just a shock is a hit and a reverse or deflected. So this is not really deflected, but sort of similar thing happening. So very.
What is the gamma of the contact
of spike? This one?
Yeah.
This is the gamma for the jet in the frame of the contact discontinuity. So actually, if someone wanted to know the new details of the things, I have a write-up. A little complicated. If I try to explain, maybe it takes a half an hour. It's only for that thing. So. And also, of course, our paper tells a little bit, but only one third or something. So can we move on?
Yeah.
Okay. So this is one already very nice talk, Shiloni and Imagine. And I think this paper is already out, so if you want to know the details. No, I'm not going to the detail. And also, Shilva said they're writing papers, so hopefully coming up in a month or so. And but they did some other cases. So if you wanted a paper, I have a paper. A little bit difficult to get. So if you want to have a paper, I have this one. So what we did is, this was testing. And thanks to the Ake and Jakob helped us to do this calculation. So this case is, of course, I didn't put detail because so not so much. This case, my OTP is this way and coming moving this way and then over here. Then this is a spectrum. Of course, zero means different from this. But anyway, important thing is that you can get ordinary synchrotron radiation. And then what we did here is a more realistic case, so gyrating, moving toward this, toward you, then you can get this. And this is a different angle. And interesting, this case is the critical angle is 4.25. So as you see, zero is a little bit smaller, and then some angle all going up and then going down for that 20, 30, 40. So this is very usable. So, and we checked that this case for the analytical result is a perfect fit. So we believe our calculation is correct. Then what we are going to do is just this is very small, so testing our code again in a different way. So we did some small simulation up to this time. Then at this point, we can choose randomly electron, jet electron, and ambient randomly. Then we follow the electrons, jet electron and background ambient electrons with simulation, not for test particle. Then this is the last time. So of course, obviously, I can remember that moving this much. So only moving 75, so very small portion moving. And then what we get is this. So we did 0 degree mean moving toward you, and a little five degree off. Then of course background noise, so even I shouldn't show this, but anyway, just for make sure the background is really weak. Then you can see sort of blameless line. This is our simulation, our case. And only just bending a little bit. Then you can get like this. And then of course this is gamma 7, this is 15, so this maximum is much higher. And also the reason kind of tapering off is even weak, some turbulent magnitude created. So a little bit, particle is not really smooth. That give you a little higher tail. And then we compared with it's the exact same, and then the only difference is jet speed. And obviously, head-on radiation is much higher, and also higher frequency because of gamma is higher. And then interesting is if a little bit off, so almost straight, so very weak radiation. So this is expected, but this is not interesting because nothing happened, just almost like a straight Bremsline-like radiation. So obviously we need this calculation in a more realistic case. It's much larger. Hopefully we'll try to do the simulation which I showed previously. And obviously some acceleration. So hopefully we can get some, of course it should be going down, and then some structure, and then also depend on the, also difficulty is so huge particle number, and then you can't do all of them, so you need to choose. So right now what I'm doing is how to choose, where to choose, or maybe intentionally randomly choose, but those things are there. Even only one simulation, there are many ways to choose. So that's another difficulty. So right now, how to choose, now what's the best way, and also I'm at least checking smaller case, so reasonably, at least reasonable result. So next step is doing really large simulation. That's we are working on that. And obviously, many things to do. This is our future plan. One is, of course, calculate spectrum with larger system. That small system doesn't show anything. It's for checking a code. And then different parameters. And also, obviously, to compare with the data, you need to do several different types of simulation. And then we've started some test case for smaller, for the putting a magnetic field, but we haven't got any interesting result yet. And also, this morning's people talking about turbulent magnetic field. So I don't know if it works or not, but we are also thinking about it. An ambient, then inject the jet. then obviously this case is not perpendicular. Really kind of jamming up, or at least it was to try. And also non-relativistic case, I did many years ago, only one case, so obviously Anatoly is doing a very interesting simulation, so we like to do some simulation. And this is, of course, already talked about it, so we need to find out our own code and also compare with someone else. And also, Katasan working on a, hopefully, some better way to at least minimize, not necessarily completely off. Sort of. And also, I started like Gambas 100, so my friend is pushing me, why don't you get such a much higher jet? So, but no, I don't know we can do or not, but that's a, one of the one of, so here. Maybe after this. So hopefully we can solve the problem, or at least not really bad Cherenkov, so that we can say, oh, this result should be okay or something, for even for the higher gamma. And obviously this workshop, one of the reasons is someone or we get together for not only our pick code, maybe weakness strings and what kind of things need to compare, what kind of things are kind of integrated for different method. That's I'm learning a lot, but kind of overwhelming about this aspect. But hopefully with someone's help and someone also needs a section, and then we can together with some overview. Thank you very much. Some other questions?
The first point, I don't understand why to add radiation if the simulation does not produce accelerated particles.
I'm sorry. Okay. So you mean
The first order of business should be run simulation long enough so that you get accelerated.
Yes. Yes.
Before you add radiation, because
I don't know. Of course, this is. I know that. So this is only for ourselves, because even this part not it was not easy, especially for selecting and also tracing the particle in our MPI. So that's kind of took a long time.
Interesting to calculate the radiation in a turbulent field. I mean, that's an interesting problem.
Actually, that's another reason. And also, but of course, need to be some sort of not only test particle. You need to with shock and whatever, some sort of consistency. Yes. Yes.
In your calculation of the radiation, although it may not be the right thing to emphasize, are you calculating the radiation from the independent particles incoherently, or are you allowing coherent radiation from the ensemble of particles?
And this is an ensemble.
This is a
Okay, so that I already talked about, because no way to calculate the radiation whole particle. No way.
So it's some of the incoherent radiation emission.
So what I'm doing is, of course, if you have a jet particle, maybe make it easy, 100. We're only picking like a 10. Then hopefully same one, different type of the jet electrons.
Right. Well, I guess
the question is, each particle is coherent. The twin particles are.
Yes, it's incoherent, but I mean, it could be the real situation.
Uh-huh.
You've got lots of particles all moving together.
Yes.
In the wavelength.
Oh, yes, yes.
And it could be you're seriously underestimating the emission.
Yes, that's possible. Yes. Yes.
Simulation. There could be absorption going on, too.
Yes, absorption is, of course, other things. Of course, we haven't even thought about yet for this calculation, yes. And the reason I'm kind of hesitating to pick one is our simulations, of course, some particle accelerator, but not like Anatoly's simulation yet. But should be very different from which I showed, obviously. But I don't know, for example, which part of the electron we're going to select, or maybe intentionally we need to select uniformly, we don't know yet. So that's a, so in other words, no way to use the old particle. So you need kind of intentionally, okay, I'm checking a radiation from the sort of shock region, or maybe transition region, or maybe mixture of those things. And or maybe intentionally hold jet for some slices. So we haven't done that far yet. And also we need pretty small time step. So it looks easy, but in reality not. Do you have any other questions?
So there's good reason that you only need a small fraction of the particles to get the radiation. If you have a billion particles, I don't know how many, do we need 100,000 or something? We don't need more than the radiation taking only a fraction of the computing time. And the reason is this. The particles sample, you follow them through time. You have to follow them through time to integrate up the radiation. So the same particle will sample a lot of space. And since the structures, furthermore, are not really down to the grid size, and within, let's say, a 10 by 10 by 10 grid, you have 1,000 times the number of particle cells. You have maybe 50,000 particles in there. The structures are really oversampled.
No, I'm sure you can sample it. It's just a question of if there are phase relations between the motions of the particles.
You are referring to a collective mechanism,
yes,
as opposed to just particles.
Yes, yes, collective.
Collective
effects, yeah.
Collective effects.
Yeah, they're going to be bunched on scale. They would need something to the radiation.
The wavelengths of the radiation we're computing here is much, much shorter than the scale of our simulation. So our grid is much larger than the synchrotron wavelength. So there is no way we can tell.
So there's no way we can be incoherent. Okay, so then you're always looking at, it's always going to be incoherent on that scale. Okay, that's right. But still, there's a possibility of absorption, I'd say.
And by the way, as you are dealing with macroparticles, you effectively have a coherent radiation from a bunch of particles, which represents one macroparticle. So that's. Yeah.
Of course, you observe coherent emission from solar radio bursts. So I mean, this is a phenomenon that actually happens.
I'm trying to translate your statement in view of Doppler beaming and Doppler effects and so forth.
Yeah, that's included automatically. Because as you showed, for example, this one.
If the motion, if the motion of the clump, the radius of curvature is larger than the clump itself, then, the reason that the wavelength of the radiation is smaller is because of relativistic effect. Mm-hmm. And therefore, if I can say this right, it's not obvious, as long as you have good time resolution, that you should not be able to calculate this radiation.
Yes, that's another reason we need very small time step to avoid some numerical Nyquist problem. That's another reason.
The clump has to move a very small fraction of its own length. With
time scale. 1/γ² of the longer radius.
1/γ to some power, yeah. And you should be able to calculate this. I mean, and it's very interesting because there was this mysterious mysterious coherent radio burst from the deep cosmos last year, and it
passed as far. They claim that it could be sort of interference.
So it's disappeared?
Practically, yes. As far as I know, on 100-page theoretical paper. They analyzed it carefully and they cannot confirm that it was real.
If it had been real.
Oh, yeah.
But the point is that, you know, this stuff is detectable if it's there. I mean, there is some grounds for looking for it. Yeah. Both theoretically and observationally.
Okay, we have giant pulses from radio pulsers.
Yes.
You could get them from shocks too, possibly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It sounds like you brought some new radio from solar bursts.
Yeah.
It's coherent, you know, of this type. Mm-hmm. But not relativistic, though. I mean, people aren't really doing that. Your lot might be doing this for non-relativistic shocks, is that right? They're calculating the radiation.
We haven't done it.
I mean, it seems to me it's interesting to try to do this, but, you know, again, it's non-relativistic.
We do it for the
Yeah, sure.
Well, the cookie should be almost ready.
Can I ask the audience, is the amount of heating in excess of 10% in electrons, in non-relativistic shocks, is that ruled out by observation?
No, the recent paper for
probably required.
No, X-ray people must say that they never observed 10 keV electrons in supernova in galactic,
right.
In any case, mm-hmm. So it's really because if you have a parallel shock such as strong heating, I think in supernova remnant some part of shock is parallel, so according to your result, should observe 10 keV electrons there, but more. It seems it is not so.
Right, so
this is some contradiction.
It's a problem, right?
Yeah. Well, the subshock would be considerably weaker.
In the big simulations, look at the real plasma physics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe it's make chill, because instead of 10, you will have 2.
You mean you slow down the flow?
Yes.
You can slow down the flow.
Yeah,
actual plasma shock is quite weak compared to the shocky stuff.
Plus, all the plasma vanishes all together.
I think you probably reduce to the point where you get just enough injection. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're getting one few percent injection. And supernova remnants just can't handle that. There isn't enough energy. We know that the effect of injection, as we've seen on this wall, those really is probably to weaken the shock to the point where it just delivers you what you need.
Yeah, that's what
that said. Yeah, but 1% in supernova remnants is not bad in reality, so...
Is that what?
1% for injection is okay.
It's too much. It's too much.
No, it's too much. Why? Way too much.
Why? Oh, I know in some of the conversation at lunch. Yes. 10 to the minus 4 is an injection efficiency.
No.
Oh,
sorry?
No.
It's per energy.
So,
that's a different.
I'm not very confused. Okay, well,
no, 10 to the minus 4 is a weird type of proton ratio, let's say, in
general. To give them rigidity.
Relativistic
rigidity. Yeah. But then that seems very low.
Yes, it's extremely low.
I don't understand the provenance of that number. Okay, I have to understand that in your office. Okay.
I think
it's significant.
Yeah, okay.
Surprising.
Yeah.
Sorry?
Surprising.